This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zand in for Jane Lindholm. It's estimated more than 7,000 refugees have settled in Vermont over the years. They came from Asia, Africa, Europe, the Middle East. The journey can be arduous, but once here they face a new set of challenges that come with building a new life in a new country, adjusting to our culture, learning the language, and finding work. Today we'll talk with representatives of two Vermont organizations that help refugees deal with these challenges, and we'll talk about what they're doing to prepare for the possible arrival of those fleeing current conflicts in Syria, North Africa, and elsewhere. If you have questions or comments about the effort to resettle refugees in Vermont, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-639-2211, or you can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. 1-800-639-2211 or vermontedition@vpr.net. And we're joined for our conversation today by Emila Mirzanovic, the director of the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program, and Alicia Laramie, who's program director at the Association for Africans Living in Vermont. Thank you both for coming in today.
Thank you.
I thought we could just try to put this in perspective a little bit. And by this, I mean what's been happening in the last couple of years. It's been focused largely on the refugee crisis in Syria. But, you know, we're hearing so much now about refugees. How dramatic a difference is what we're seeing from what might happen if there is such thing as a typical year in terms of the number of refugees?
So historically, Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program has resettled between 325 and 350 refugees per year. The United States takes 70,000 refugees mm-hmm. per year. VRP is a field office of National Network, U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, which takes about 8,000
refugees. That's the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program.
And VRP mm-hmm. is a field office. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing today, obviously, is the magnitude of Syrian crisis is enormous. It's the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II. Half of Syria's population has been displaced, so 10 million people. 4 million are registered as refugees in the region around Syria.
Mm-hmm. So, Emila, we've heard in recent days that the United States, which typically accepts about 70,000 refugees, is now upping that number. Initially, it was an additional 10,000, and now by 2017, I believe the number will be 100,000.
Yes.
How significant is that? Does that
right.
make a big difference?
So we were glad, and when I say we, refugee advocates are glad to see the increase to 85,000 for next fiscal year and then to 100,000 in 2017. But we still are asking for 100,000 Syrians to be admitted in 2016, and in addition to 85,000. And, you know, if we look at the historically, the U.S. Has been, the leader in refugee resettlement in accepting the most number of refugees out of all 28 countries who are designated for refugee resettlement. So we should still push for more admissions.
So you're talking about significantly more. Does that mean the 30,000, the additional 30,000, is really not that helpful?
It is helpful, but if we take into account the magnitude, again, of the Syrian crisis, it's really a drop in a huge sea.
Let's talk just for a second about your two organizations. Emila Mirzanovic, you're with the Vermont Refugee Assistance Resettlement Program, that is, and Alicia Laramie, you're with the Association for Africans Living in Vermont. You don't do the same things, do you? Can you sort of characterize how you work together, Alicia?
So AALV is a mutual aid association, and we're a multi-ethnic community-based organization located in Burlington, right sort of in the heart of where most of the refugees are resettled in Chittenden County. And we should say that, you know, when we talk about refugee resettlement in Vermont, we're really talking primarily about Chittenden County, with a few exceptions. But so AALV really starts working with refugees at about the one-year mark when refugees become permanent residents. And whereas VRRP is resettling people from you know, when they get off the plane, literally
the initial stages, more
yes,
or less,
to that 1 year. So our services, we don't want to recreate the services, and we're not a refugee resettlement organization. We start our services at about that 1 year, and we're looking at sort of long-term integration. We're providing a number of the same resources that VRRP does, some of the case management assistance with finding affordable housing, employment, healthcare, all of those things that people need when they are resettled. But we also do a number of programs through AALV, some things, workforce development initiatives where we help people with, for example, we have a program, a child care training program that helps moms who may not be able to easily enter the workforce, be able to open child care programs within their homes. We offer personal care attendant programs. So we're looking at sort of the longer term integration and trying to really respond to the needs of the community once they've been here and members of the communities, the various communities that we work with. And we work with all refugee communities that are resettled in Vermont, and responding to their needs beyond the initial resettlement period.
You pointed out, and I think most people know this, that most refugees are resettled in Chittenden County. Is that just a function of your two organizations being here, or are there other reasons?
There are a number of other reasons, and I think Amila can also speak to this, but a lot of this has to do with access to resources. So resettling people in places where you're going to have public transportation, for example, and public transportation that can get you to the grocery store, that can get you to the hospital, that can help meet all of those very basic and crucial needs. So it's a lot of it has to do with the resources that are in the area that people have been resettled.
Amila, since your organization works with people at those very initial stages, mm-hmm. from the point of their arrival,
yes.
what happens first? What are the very first things that happen?
Right. So VRRP provides basic needs to new arrivals, from the airport reception to finding the first housing, sometimes second, to providing a warm meal and furnishing an apartment, which comes through donations from our community, and then employment services. So we help everyone with that, finding that first job, and sometimes the second job, and then English as English language classes, medical case management, and limited cash assistance. So we work with refugees for about a year in that capacity. Mm-hmm. I should also add that we have a very strong community engagement program. Refugee resettlement is a public private partnership, and without the support of our community, our work wouldn't be possible.
I think you've mentioned that perhaps 325 to 350 refugees arrive in Vermont on an annual basis.
Yes.
How is that determined? I mean, there are other programs associated with yours or mm-hmm. similar to yours across the country, obviously, and
right.
and the vast majority of refugees are going elsewhere. At the present rate, 70,000 are coming into the
right.
country. How is it determined that an individual or a family will come to Vermont?
So Vermont has been a designated refugee resettlement site for, over 35 years. It started back in late 70s with refugees fleeing former Soviet Union and other Eastern European countries, and then with resettlement of Vietnamese and then Bosnians during the 90s, and Sudanese later on, Somalis and so forth. The decision is made basically whether there is an existing community in Vermont, and if the group is new to Vermont, obviously we look at the resources and the capacity in the community. And as I mentioned, Vermont we're very lucky. Both of our organizations can speak to that. We depend on the generosity of our community. and the support.
When you were mentioning the housing necessary and the various, you know, obviously all of this takes money. Mm-hmm. Does it all come from donations? Aren't there federal funds or other government funds involved? Maybe you can speak to that, Alicia.
Yeah, so ALV gets a lot of its funding through federal programming, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and as well as the Vermont has a state refugee coordinator who helps with grants, state grants. So we get our funding both from federal and state grants, as well as some private funding as well. So and we accept donations.
So there is some state money involved in
yes,
addition
there is.
To the federal money. And,
yeah.
You know, just in terms of an annual budget, can you put a figure on that?
I don't know that number.
Okay.
Sorry.
As we look, Amila, at the Syrian refugees coming to this country, where do conversations stand right now about whether we'll see Syrian refugees coming to Vermont, and what are the considerations?
So we certainly are looking to resettle Syrian refugees. Our plan for fiscal year 2016 is to resettle refugees from Syria. You know, how many will come and when, I can't, we don't know for certain. It's, you know, really important for me to say that, you know, it takes about 1,000 days to process a refugee. So it's not like, you know, the decision is made today, we will take 100,000 Syrian refugees and they are on our shores, so to speak, tomorrow. There is a long process and many federal agencies are involved in that process.
You mentioned that among the criteria you mentioned a moment ago was whether there's an existing community.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I don't know if there's an existing Syrian community in this area.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would think that in larger urban areas, there mm-hmm. are more established immigrant and refugee communities than mm-hmm. perhaps Vermont has. So what argues for Syrian refugees coming to Vermont?
We also have a well-established refugee community. We as you mentioned at the beginning, Vermont is home to about 7,000. We resettled about 7,000 refugees over the last 35 years. Our economy is very strong. Vermont is a peaceful place, a welcoming place. Vermonters are, you know, generous, and they open their homes to new refugees. As I mentioned, we have a community engagement program which works with hundreds of volunteers on a daily basis who are assisting refugee families with transportation, with various needs. So even though we don't have an existing Syrian refugee community, we have a strong refugee history.
We're talking today about the refugee community in Vermont, the prospect of Syrian refugees coming to the state, and how refugees are helped in terms of their efforts to get jobs, become established in our communities. We're speaking with Amila Mirzanovic of the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program and Alicia Laramie of the Association for Africans Living in Vermont, welcoming your calls at 1-800-639-2211 and your emails at vermontedition@vpr.net. We have a pretty low unemployment rate, Alicia, and I wonder if you could talk to us about the steps taken to try to secure jobs for refugees arriving in Vermont.
Well, many of the refugees arriving in Vermont are highly skilled, highly educated, multilingual individuals, and they bring with them a wealth of experiences in their home countries. So finding jobs and employment once they move to Vermont can look very different depending on the individual. Some of them face language barriers, others do not, but people will run into the challenge of certain degrees and not having the right accreditation to find work in a similar field in the United States. So for some people, it's a matter of trying to figure out how to get the right accreditation or get the right education to then, you know, some more education to then go back into that field. So for some people, that's their track. For other people, they find themselves in situations where they are finding temporary employment. And for those people, it can be more challenging depending on, you know, what kind of job is available to them. But there's also issues of child care at home as well. You know, that's one of the – that can be a challenge for families and making sure that they have child care. But when we talk about resettling refugees in established areas or making sure that you bring in a community of people. So if we are to resettle Syrians here, it's important to – and people know this from experience – that you should – try to resettle as many as you can of one community, because within that there are lots of resources, and you find grandparents becoming the child care providers for grandchildren while parents can go out and get employment. So there's, you know, there's lots of things at play.
Alicia, you mentioned many come with skills. How often are they fortunate enough to find a job that's a good match for those skills?
It can be quite challenging, but I think, you know, because Chittenden County and Burlington, we've been doing this work for a long time, and we've learned a lot along the way, that the longer we are understanding the kinds of needs, the more employers are understanding the assets that the refugee community can bring, and they're more open to the idea of providing employment in the workplace. I think that the community college and the different local universities, they're also trying to find ways to help people figure out how to do that accreditation. But it's taken a while for us to figure out that there are missing links in our system.
Here's a question probably for Amila. It comes from Mark, who posted this. He says, at the top of the show, Ms. Merzanovic stated that most of the refugees to date have tended to cluster in the Chittenden County area. This makes sense because of available public transport, walkable towns and cities, job availability, etc. And Mark asks, has there historically been any objections to the efforts of the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program based on the projected potential cost to the local school districts? Do the folks that have been resettled have issues finding primary care providers, since they all presumably will be signed up for Medicaid? And how do resettled individuals afford to pay high rents in Chittenden County? So a number of questions there from
yes,
Mark.
Yes, right. So historically, as I said, we have had a great support from the community. We work closely with number of service providers in the area to ensure that, you know, we provide quality services to new arrivals. You know, on the point of high housing cost, we can't argue that, obviously. But we have a strong economy. If we didn't have a strong economy, we wouldn't have a housing problem. So we work with number of landlords in the area to ensure that all new arrivals go to their apartment, and our employment team works with employable adults in the family to ensure that the first job that they get can cover the expenses. So we have, you know, we work with something like 30 employers on a regular basis who are calling us all the time and asking for more people.
The other part of Mark's question had to do with healthcare providers and Medicaid.
Yes. So all refugees are eligible for Medicaid initially. And we work with several healthcare providers in the area, including Infectious Disease Clinic at University Medical Center and community
I guess,
health centers.
You know, just Mark's general question at the beginning was, do people object sometimes to out of concerns over cost, impact on housing availability, and these other concerns Mark raised? And what's your response when people say, gee, I don't know, you know, we've got enough problems already in terms of a tight housing market or healthcare costs?
Right. I always like to shift that conversation in the direction of, but let's look at the benefits that refugees bring to our state. You know, we know Vermont is one of the widest states in the country. You know, we And then on the other side, you have people who take pride in, you know, living in a diverse community. So refugee resettlement certainly contributes to that. Also, you know, refugees go to work quickly, sometimes within 90 days. So if you remember what I said previously, it takes 1,000 days to process a refugee to bring them to the United States. You know, the federal programs are designed to help refugees go to work within 90 days and achieve self-sufficiency. People are working, they're paying taxes, they're buying homes. So our Bhutanese community, which is about 2,000 people, 60 are homeowners already. They've only been in the country for 7-8 years. They're buying homes and they're renting apartments to other families. So that's a very good statistic for any community.
All right. We'll be talking actually a little about the Bhutanese community a little later in the program. But right now we're talking more generally about refugee assistance in Vermont, the resources necessary, the resources available to refugees coming to Vermont, and particularly as we think ahead to the possibility of Syrian refugees coming here. If you have comments, questions, we welcome them at 1-800-639-2211. Or you can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zind in for Jane Lindholm today and joined by Emila Mirdzanovic, who is the director of the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program, and Alicia Laramie of the Association for Africans Living in Vermont as we talk about how refugees are resettled in Vermont. And take your calls at 1-800-639-2211. In fact, we've got a call from Judy in St. George. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment that 13 years ago, I hosted a refugee family as a volunteer, and it has sparked my thinking as I've been listening to the program today that while certainly it's not possible that we Vermonters can resettle the millions of Syrians who have been displaced, for each family that we can resettle, we are literally saving their lives. Some of the people who were resettled at that time are currently working as teachers and accountants. There are some who are in law school and business school. So we had an incredible opportunity to save people's lives. They are now contributing to our community, contributing their talents.
Thanks very much, Judy. Appreciate the call. Alicia, Emila talked about the apartments and finding housing for refugees arriving here. Are they sometimes resettled, at least initially, with host families?
Well, that would be more on the Emila side of refugee resettlement, since ALV really deals with people mm-hmm. after 1 year. But not to my knowledge. I don't know.
Right. So we, years ago, probably 10 or 12 years ago, we had a program. So as part of our community engagement programs, we initially placed families with the host family for about 2 to 3 weeks. At the time, we were resettling a population of Somali Bantu who spent, you know, many years in the refugee camp in Kenya and were not exposed necessarily to modern amenities. So this way, you know, we use that opportunity to connect them, not only to connect them with American family in the community, who then would serve as an extra support to that family, but yeah. also for, you know, community orientation.
You know, Emila, you mentioned a while ago that it takes a long time to do this processing. Mm-hmm. Syrian refugees are not going to be arriving anytime soon. What generally is involved in that? Is that just, determining that you are, in fact, a refugee? Or
exactly.
Are there other things?
That is the first step. So an individual has to be recognized as a refugee. It has to fit that status. And a refugee is someone, as we know, who has crossed an international border and is unable or unwilling to return to their country of origin due to a well-founded fear of persecution based on religion, race, nationality, political opinion. So that's the first step. The UN agency responsible for protection and assistance of refugees is the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. They are the ones who will look at durable solutions. Refugee resettlement, let me mention, is never an emergency response. There are three what they're called durable solutions: repatriation, local integration, and then refugee resettlement as a last option.
Local integration, let's say in the case of Syrian refugees being in neighboring countries?
Right. Okay. Which, I mean, if we think about Lebanon, currently Lebanon is hosting 2 or 3 million Syrian refugees. I recently heard that on every four people, two are Lebanese, one is Syrian, one is Palestinian. So local integration obviously would not be a possibility in that instance. On the side of the U.S. refugee program, as I mentioned, there are a number of federal agencies who are involved in processing, including Department of Homeland Security, USCIS, the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Refugees are subjected to, you know, layers of security screenings, medical screenings before they can travel.
All right, back to the phones, and let's take a call now from Kat in Winooski. Hi, Kat.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
Oh, hi. So I guess I'm calling because I have a contrary experience to what your guests are talking about in terms of how well supported the refugees are and how well cared for and ushered through the whole process. And that I have rental property and I rented to some refugees and they were very well supported to get into the apartment. They were very well supported in the payment of their rent in that the state and the government paid it 100%. But they were not supported in integrating themselves into the culture, the language, the jobs. They have a very insular community. Now, I know that different cultures, you know, the Syrian culture is going to be very different from the Nepalese, going to be very different from the Sudanese. But it was a very misfortunate, I mean, that literally, experience for me. They were nice people, but they just had no support in terms of how to be and how to integrate and how to function in our world here. And it became a big problem for me as a property owner.
Kat, thanks very much for the call. Alicia, maybe we can start with you and you can speak to this. I mean, we're talking about 325 to 300 refugees coming to Vermont annually. That's not a huge number of people, but it's not a small number of people when you're talking about helping people who really need resources and skills in a whole range of areas. I mean, is this Catwood is suggesting that maybe this is beyond the resources of organizations like yours and they're not getting enough help?
Well, I think, we're also resettling individuals, and it's difficult. Sometimes, you know, you can group people together, but you also have to look at individuals and individual families and where people feel comfortable. And people often feel comfortable being with people that are like themselves, where they have a common language. And so if people feel more comfortable in that and they're not acculturating as quickly as people would like, I mean, there's something to be said for the fact that different communities come with different experiences as well, depending on, what your experience was in a refugee camp, for example, might make your acculturation process easier when you get to the United States. So if you've had a lot of education or you've had access to English, that can really make a difference in how quickly you integrate into the culture, how quickly you're able to find employment and navigate the very complex systems that the United States has in place. So there's a lot for people to learn in when people arrive. And it often does help if, as we've mentioned a few times, you know, if people have others in the community that can guide them through processes that they might not know. And whether or not people seek out the services.
I was going to ask how incumbent is it on people to ask for your help as opposed to your needing to be constantly in touch with them?
It's up to people to ask for help. I mean, we have clients coming through our doors every day, and we work with people from all the different communities. But people need to take the initiative. I mean, we have programs that we offer, and we'll do a lot of outreach and recruitment to help with people. But unless they're asking for assistance, it's hard to know that there's a problem or an issue out there that people are dealing with.
On Kat mentioned that the family that she was referring to, their rent was paid for. How long does that kind of support continue? As long as needed?
So the federal government gives us $925 per person for all new arrivals. And
per
that money.
Month or?
That's a one time payment. It. Yeah, $925. So if you're a single person, and you know, that money doesn't take you very far. If you're a family, obviously, it can be stretched up to about 90 days. That money is used to pay for deposit and first month's rent, maybe even consecutive rents, utilities, initial food, and maybe a bus pass and, you know, some household goods. We also, as I mentioned, provide, have three employment program and provide limited cash assistance, which can go up to 5 months or 8 months. But in that time frame, you know, refugees are expected to go to work and reach self-sufficiency.
Let's go back to the phones. Michael is calling us from Plainfield. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program.
My question is about the religious infrastructure. I know when the resettlement of Tibetans began in the 70s in the Burlington area, that subsequently helped refugees from Bhutan and Nepal, particularly because there was similar language and also a nearly identical religious infrastructure. I'm wondering how it would be for Muslim communities in Burlington, whether the Syrian and Iraqi refugees in particular would have a pre-identified community in their shared Muslim religion, and how much those folks have expressed interest in supporting new refugees.
Thanks for the call, Michael. Amila Mirzanovic.
Yes. So there is a sizable Muslim community in Vermont, and there is a Islamic Society Center right here in Colchester with members from different Muslim communities that, you know, have come here as refugees or immigrants. We on occasion have sought, you know, support and assistance from the center and vice versa.
Are you, Michael, I think, asked, are you hearing from the Islamic Center or members of the Muslim community now who say, gee, Syrian refugees are coming, how can we help?
Yeah, we are. Only last week, for example, in the two-hour period, we had like 50 calls from, you know, different Vermonters from around the state offering to help.
And I guess that brings up the broader question is, if people are listening and obviously they're seeing the news stories and reading the headlines, what can they do? They can't be host families apparently, but can either of you speak to how Vermonters can help out?
So through our community engagement program, as I said, we have hundreds of volunteers who are working with new Americans as we speak. There are many ways to get engaged. You know, we hope to resettle Syrians, and we look forward to that. But there are refugees in our state now who could be supported. We have a family friend program. We have English language tutoring, mentoring program. We are constantly collecting donations of household goods. And we certainly take donations, monetary donations.
You know, a lot of the people who are in refugee status obviously have come from pretty horrific situations. We know a lot more and hear a lot more than we once did today about the effects of war on the psychological and emotional effects on war. Do either of you see that, you know, whether it's post-traumatic stress or other effects? And are your organizations equipped to deal with that?
Right. Certainly we see, you know, individuals who have witnessed horrific, who have gone through horrific events in their lives prior to coming here. You know, they've witnessed loss of their loved ones, their properties. So, you know, for some people, when they arrive here, they're struggling with psychological issues. There are resources in the community. There are scares, but there are resources in the community that we can connect them with.
All right. Well, thank you both very much, and good luck in your efforts as we contemplate Syrian refugees coming to Vermont. We've been talking with Amila Merdzanovich of the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program and Alicia Laramie, who's with the Association for Africans Living in Vermont. Coming up in just a moment, we'll hear about another immigrant community, refugee community, that's hoping to build a temple here on Vermont Edition. It's estimated more than 2,000 Bhutanese refugees live in Vermont, mostly in the Burlington area. They are among 80,000 who have come to the United States in the past decade. And like other refugee communities, they adapt to their adopted culture, but also strive to preserve aspects of their native culture, including their religion. For that reason, efforts are underway by Bhutanese refugees to build a Hindu temple in Burlington. And here to tell us about that is Bidur Dahal. He's a member of the Vermont Hindu Temple's Interim Executive Committee. Bidur, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Well, I know there have been Bhutanese in our area for about a decade now. How have they worshipped up until now?
Let me go a little bit to the background. Vermont Hindu Temple was officially formed in June 2015 as a 501c3 Vermont nonprofit public benefit membership organization founded by a group of Bhutanese Nepali refugees to celebrate and promote Hindu culture and values in Vermont, and the membership is open to all.
But again, you know, when Bhutanese refugees came to Vermont, they brought their religious practices with them. Without a temple, how difficult has it been to observe those practices?
Exactly. That was the very much need of the time. The strong need is felt owing to Hindu cultural belief, as expressed in great Hindu epic Srimad Bhagavata, that a community without a temple of the god would make the living of the people difficult and spiritually hollow. And I'd like to add that non-existence of such culturally appropriate spiritual space have, despite the physical and economic well-being experienced in the resettled country, was a difficult people. So the need came from the people, from the community, that we need to have a Hindu temple of our own.
Would you say most Bhutanese then want to maintain their religious practices and are not so secular, perhaps?
What we need to understand is that religion, culture, and way of life is so much interlinked in our culture that you cannot just separate that. It's a culture, it's a religion, it's a way of life. So it's all together. It's a bundle. So it's not about just religion and promoting that religion, but it's a way of life. So there's a strong need of that.
So for most of us who have never been inside a Hindu temple, what are the features like? What is it like that you're trying to create?
So there is always we recently have the main purpose of this LAP. So it's a promote and practice philosophy of Hinduism through worship and education, and assist members of community to improve their lives, and establish some spiritual and relationship. Of between non-Hindus communities also, to have some sort of cultural exchange. So we invite, we welcome everybody. We have recently, some time ago, we have rented a space for a Saturday, 3 hours morning in 173 North Prospect Street, which is known as Prince Meeting House. We gather there, and we do yoga classes. We have some gurus, teachers who have provide spiritual sermons, and we have cultural dances and spiritual songs. And we celebrate our major Hindu festivals, so whichever fall in the way. So we do that. And it's open to everybody, not only to Hindus, it's everybody.
So that's something, I'm sorry, you say you do every Saturday at the Quaker Friends Meeting House?
Yes. We have rented a space for 3 hours on every Saturday from 10 to 1. And sometimes we extend that after talking to friends' place. We meet there every Saturday.
How far along, then, are you in the process of trying to establish a temple?
Yeah, we have officially been granted officially registered as a Vermont Hindu temple in Vermont from June. And recently in August, we have received the 501c3 status also.
And how much money do you need to raise to make this a reality?
We need a lot of money because our main aim is to establish a Hindu temple because we don't have one in Vermont. So we need at least some land and to construct a Hindu temple. It requires some amount of money, definitely.
So you're really starting from scratch. You want to buy land and build a building.
That's our aim, because people think that it should be in a very quiet and nice, place, because that's how people perceive as a temple, that it should be in a very quiet and quiet place.
When do you hope to have it built, the door?
We don't know, but we are just starting and we are working towards that, and our aim is to go one by one, step by one step, so that we can always reach. If you don't start, then you never reach. So that's the aim.
All right. Well, best of luck.
Thank you so much for having me and giving me opportunity to talk a little bit about Vermont Hindu Temple.
Thank you, Badur. Badur Badhal Dahal is a member of the Vermont Hindu Temple's Interim Executive Committee. Now we want to take a couple of minutes and dip into the Vermont Edition mailbag and read some of the comments we've received recently. And I'm joined by our producer, Patty Daniels. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Steve. Last week we talked about the possible legalization of marijuana in Vermont. And that conversation continued online well after the show ended. Here's a few comments from our online posters. Patrick says, many of the arguments I've heard for not legalizing marijuana are important things to consider. Teen use, impaired driving, and the health risks of smoking are all things that we need to be accounted for with regulations and education.
And Patrick goes on to say, but none of these are reasons to criminalize a relatively benign substance, forcing those who want to use it into the shadows. Law enforcement and the court should not be wasting resources on marijuana when they would be much better served focusing on heroin and gun trafficking. Marijuana as a public health issue is not a reason to continue prohibition. Drug use in general should be looked at through the lens of public health, namely treatment, education, and regulation.
And Alice posted an opposing view. She writes, if government wants to be a tool for good, how about backing us up when we try to protect our kids from the scourge of drugs and not send the message, okay, they're just going to do it anyway. I watched what drugs did to our family and how it broke my parents' hearts. And then I suffered watching my own teen take that path and how we did everything imaginable to help.
And Alice adds, the idea of legalizing marijuana is so short-sighted, it's laughable. You can talk about the revenue, but what about the cost? It's tough enough to parent in our society today. Can't you just back us up rather than undermining our authority even more?
And switching topics, last week on Monday, we talked about why it's important to examine white identity in Vermont, one of the whitest states in the country. Pat posted this comment, as a white person, my white identity, quote unquote, colors every aspect of my life. I don't have to think about how anyone might interpret my behavior based on my race. I don't have to worry that many people might think I got hired from my job due to affirmative action. even though historically white women have been the primary beneficiaries of affirmative action.
And Julie wrote into the same program saying, I was born white into a lower middle class family in the Northeast Kingdom and didn't even think about white privilege until my black boyfriend moved to Vermont to live with me. He was really uncomfortable when we go shopping because I would pick up DVDs and CDs and not buy them. He said he was taught not to pick things up unless he was going to buy them, so clerks didn't think he was stealing. Then I understood that by being a white middle-class woman, I was not targeted in the way he was.
And if you have any thoughts about any of our shows, you can post them online or write in to vermontedition@vpr.net. We love hearing from you.
Thank you, Patty.
You're welcome.
And thanks for joining us today. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, Guardians Ad Litem. Every child at the center of an abuse or neglect case is assigned a volunteer adult to look out for that child's interest as the case progresses. We'll look at the role these volunteers play in a system that's come under scrutiny. If you're a guardian ad litem, tell us about your experience. You can do that by writing to vermontedition@vpr.net. And listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Steve Zind. Thanks for listening.